The Duke of Blackwood did not consider the acquisition of a wife to be a matter of the heart. It was a matter of ink and ledgers, of assets and liabilities. His solicitor, Mr. Finch, a man whose face seemed composed entirely of parchment and dry legal precedents, had laid it all out with dispassionate clarity. Lord Vance, a man of fine lineage and even finer gambling debts, was ruined. His single asset of any consequence was his daughter, Eleonora. The Duke, in turn, required a duchess. It was a neat, if unromantic, solution. A barony saved, a ducal line secured. Alistair, the Duke, had met her precisely once before the contracts were drawn. She had been a whisper in a pale gray dress, standing by a window in her father's crumbling library, looking out at a garden choked with weeds. He remembered noting her stillness, the way she seemed to absorb the light rather than reflect it. She was present, and she was absent. She was there, and she was not there. He had registered her existence as one might register a piece of furniture that came with a newly purchased house, necessary, unobtrusive, and of no particular interest beyond its function. Her father, a man perpetually flushed with wine and desperation, had done all the talking. He spoke of his daughter's quiet temperament, her skill with household accounts, her biddable nature. He was selling a horse, describing its sound teeth and strong back. The Duke had listened with half an ear, his gaze sweeping over the peeling paint and water-stained ceiling of the Vance ancestral home. The place reeked of decay, a genteel poverty that was somehow more offensive than the honest squalor of the city slums. He would erase the debt, and in return, he would take the girl. Eleonora Vance had said nothing at all during the entire negotiation. When her father had presented her, she had curtsied, her eyes fixed on a point somewhere near his polished boots. He had found her plain, not aggressively so, but lacking any feature that caught the eye or held the imagination. She was a line drawing in a world that demanded oil paintings. It did not matter. A duchess was a title, a manager for his homes, a future mother for his heir. Beauty was a commodity for mistresses, not a requirement for wives. So the papers were signed. The debts were cleared. The quiet girl in the gray dress became the Duchess of Blackwood. Her name appended to his as simply as a codicil to a will. The wedding was a small, brutally efficient affair at the fat owner's country seat, Blackwood Manor, a place as imposing and emotionally vacant as the Duke himself. Afterward, in the cavernous drawing room, Lord Harrington, a man whose friendship with the Duke was based on a shared boredom with the world, clapped him on the shoulder. Harrington was all polished surfaces and easy charm, his eyes holding the glint of casual cruelty that so often passed for wit in their circle. "Well, Blackwood, you've done it," Harrington said, his voice a low drawl. "Tied yourself to the little mouse. Hope you find the arrangement satisfactory. She doesn't seem the sort to cause a fuss." Alistair took a sip of his brandy, the amber liquid, a familiar fire in his throat. He looked across the room where his new wife was speaking quietly with the housekeeper, Mrs. Gable. She was already at work, it seemed. Efficient. Good. "The arrangement is a matter of business, Harrington. Nothing more," Alistair replied. His tone clipped. He felt a flicker of irritation. Note. Harrington's comment, though typical, seemed to cheapen an already base transaction. A duchess is a role. A set of duties to be performed. "And the performer?" Harrington pressed, a smirk playing on his lips. "What if she proves inadequate to the part?" The Duke gave a short, dismissive laugh. The brandy had warmed him, loosening the tight bands of control he usually wore. He felt a swell of ducal arrogance, the immense, unthinking power that had been his from birth. He was Blackwood. The world bent to his will. Wives, like horses or houses, could be managed. "Then the performer will be replaced," he said, the words careless and cold. "She is, after all, easily replaced." He did not know, would not know for a very long time, that the object of his dismissive pronouncement was not, in fact, engaged in conversation with the housekeeper. Eleonora had been on her way to do just that when she had paused behind a large Chinese screen. momentarily arrested by the sight of a rare winter-flowering jasmine her mother had once cultivated. She had been standing in the shadows, perfectly still, and she had heard every word. She did not flinch. She did not gasp. The world simply tilted on its axis, and when it settled, the landscape of her new life was irrevocably altered. A door had been opened, and another, inside her, had just quietly, definitively, closed. The first few months of the marriage unfolded in a state of polite, arctic distance. The Duke was a creature of rigid habit. He spent his days with his steward, his horses, or locked in his study with mountains of paperwork related to his vast and complicated estates. He spent his nights, Eleonora presumed, in a similar state of detached industry, though she could not be certain. They took their meals together in a dining room built for 50, the vast expanse of polished mahogany between them, a more effective barrier than any wall. Their conversations were models of economy. "The weather is turning, Your Grace." "Indeed." Mr. Finch mentioned the tenant farmers in the West Paddock are concerned about the blight. "I will speak with him. I will speak with him." He observed her as one might observe a new clock. He noted that she was punctual, that she ran smoothly, and that she did not make any disruptive noise. The household, which had been drifting in a state of benign neglect since his mother's death a decade prior, began to hum with a new, quiet efficiency. Dust motes vanished. The silver gleamed with a forgotten brilliance. Meals appeared on time, perfectly cooked and served. He found this pleasing. It confirmed his judgment. He had purchased a competent manager. What he did not see was the mind behind the management. He did not see Eleonora in the kitchens at dawn, not giving orders, but listening to the cook's complaints about the faulty ovens and sketching a design for a new flue that would solve the problem. He did not see her in the linen closets, discovering a trove of priceless lace his mother had stored away, cataloging it with a scholar's precision. He did not see her in the estate office late at night, long after he had retired, taking the chaotic, leather-bound ledgers that had mystified a string of educated male secretaries and imposing upon them a system of crystalline logic. She had a mind that saw patterns in chaos. Where others saw a morass of figures, she saw a narrative of waste, of inefficiency, of minor corruptions. She found that the supplier of oats for the stables had been overcharging the estate by a small but significant margin for 7 years. She found that a land parcel in the north, long thought to be barren marsh, possessed a unique clay deposit perfect for brickmaking. She made notes, she drew up summaries, she cross-referenced receipts. She worked not with the fury of ambition, but with the cool, focused pleasure of a mathematician solving an elegant proof. Mr. Finch, the solicitor who had drafted the marriage contract, was the first to notice. He was a man who appreciated order above all things, and the new Duchess was an artist of it. He had come to the manor to consult with the Duke on a legal matter, and had, out of habit, requested the household accounts for the quarter. He had expected the usual mess. Instead, he was presented with a set of books so clear, so perfectly balanced, that they were a thing of beauty. He sought out the Duke in his study. Alistair was reading a letter, a frown creasing his brow. "Your Grace," Finch began, placing the ledger on the desk, "I must commend you on your choice of secretary. The new fellow is a prodigy." Alistair looked up, distracted. "New fellow? I haven't hired anyone." "Then who?" Finch gestured to the book. "The accounts. They've never been in such order. There are notes here, in the margins. An analysis of the estate's timber yields that is more astute than anything your land agent has produced in 20 years. He pointed to a delicate, precise script. "And here, a query regarding the contract with the grain merchant. A very sharp query, I might add. It has saved you, by my estimation, some £200 this year alone." The Duke picked up the ledger. He recognized the handwriting. It was the same script that appeared on the household menus placed on the dinner table each evening. He had never given it a moment's thought. "It is the Duchess," he said, a note of surprise in his own voice. He felt a strange, unfamiliar sensation. It was as if a painting he had walked past every day had suddenly developed a new, intricate detail he had never seen before. A recalibration was taking place in his mind, a minor adjustment to his perception of the woman who shared his name. The Duchess? Finch's eyebrows, thin and gray as cobwebs, rose a fraction of an inch. Remarkable. She has a mind for figures, then. A rare talent in a lady. Alistair closed the book. A useful hobby, he said, the words coming out automatically. A defense against the unsettling feeling of having misjudged something. It keeps her occupied. He dismissed it. He filed it away under competent and efficient. It was a pleasant surprise, like finding a forgotten banknote in an old coat, but it did not fundamentally change his assessment. She was a useful acquisition. A good piece of machinery. He did not think to praise her. He did not think to thank her. He had paid for her, after all. The debt was settled. Her competence was simply part of the bargain. That evening at dinner, he found himself watching her more closely. She was wearing a dark blue dress, the color of a twilight sky. It made her pale skin seem almost luminous. Her hair was arranged in a simple but elegant coil at the nape of her neck. He noticed, for the first time, that she had very long, graceful fingers. They rested lightly on the stem of her wine glass. He felt an impulse to mention the ledgers, to acknowledge her work. But the habit of their silence was too strong. What would he say? Thank you for performing your duties with unexpected skill. It sounded absurd, patronizing. So he said nothing, and the vast mahogany desert between them remained as empty and silent as ever. The turning point, the moment the first crack appeared in the foundation of his carefully constructed world, came 2 months later. Lord Harrington came to stay for a week of shooting. Alistair, who had not seen his friend since the wedding, found the man's presence grating. Harrington's wit seemed coarser than he remembered, his charm more predatory. One afternoon, Eleonora was in the library, a vast, two-story room lined with books from floor to ceiling. It was her sanctuary. The air smelled of leather and paper, and beeswax, a scent of quiet, accumulated knowledge. She was not reading, but mending a large, illustrated atlas whose spine had broken. Her long fingers worked with delicate precision, applying glue with a tiny brush, pressing the worn leather back into place. It was a patient, meditative task, and she was entirely absorbed. She heard voices from the adjoining card room, the door of which was slightly ajar. It was Harrington and another guest, a baronet named Sir Roland. They were laughing. I tell you, Roland, it's the damnedest thing, Harrington was saying, his voice thick with wine. Blackwood marries this little country mouse, a creature of absolute zero distinction, and the man is never in London anymore. Becomes a regular hermit. Perhaps he's found domestic bliss, Sir Roland chuckled. Harrington let out a great bray of a laugh. Bliss? With that one? Don't be a fool. I was there when he sealed the deal. I asked him what he'd do if she didn't work out. You know what he said? Cold as ice, he was. Harrington lowered his voice in a theatrical imitation of the Duke. She is easily replaced. Easily replaced. The man bought a wife like he was buying a new carriage dog. They laughed again, a sound of shared, cruel amusement. Eleonora's hands did not stop their work. The tiny brush continued its steady path along the frayed leather. Not a single drop of glue was spilled. She did not breathe. She simply listened as the echo of those words, her husband's words, filled the silent library. They were not new to her. She had carried them inside her since her wedding day, but hearing them again, spoken aloud in another man's mouth, stripped of any possible ambiguity, gave them a new and terrible weight. They were not just a careless comment, they were a statement of fact, a summary of her existence in this house. She was a placeholder, a temporary fixture. She finished her work on the atlas, pressing the spine gently until the glue held. She cleaned the brush, capped the glue pot, and placed her tools in a small wooden box. She stood and looked around the library, at the thousands of books, the silent witnesses to history, to poetry, to science. It was the only part of the house that felt like a home, and it was not hers. Nothing here was hers. She was just a cog in the machine, and a replaceable one at that. From that day forward, the quiet, efficient machine of Blackwood Manor continued to run, but its soul had been removed. Alistair did not notice at first. Life continued its predictable rhythm. The house was immaculate. His meals were superb. His papers were always where he expected them to be. But a change had occurred, a subtle shift in the atmosphere that he could not immediately identify. It was like living in a house where a single, constant, low-frequency sound had ceased. One only noticed its absence after it was gone. The flowers were the first thing. For months, a small vase had appeared on his desk every morning. It was never ostentatious. A single branch of apple blossom in spring. A few sprigs of lavender in summer. A perfect crimson maple leaf in autumn. He had never consciously acknowledged them, but he had come to expect them. One Tuesday, the vase was not there. It was not there on Wednesday, or the day after. His desk seemed starker, emptier. Then it was the music. In the evenings, after dinner, he would often hear the distant, gentle sound of the pianoforte from the music room. He had assumed it was one of the maids practicing. The music was complex, often melancholic, played with a skill that was far beyond simple parlor entertainment. Now, the evenings were silent. The silence pressed in on him, heavy and absolute. At dinner, the emptiness of the chair opposite him became more pronounced. Before, while she had been quiet, he had been aware of her presence. He would catch her looking at him sometimes, her gaze thoughtful, analytical, before she would drop her eyes to her plate. Now, she never looked at him. Her eyes were always on her food, or on the tapestry-covered walls, or on the flickering candles. She answered his questions with the same polite economy, but the words were hollowed out, devoid of any inflection. She was a beautiful automaton, performing her duties with flawless precision. He was present and she was absent. She was there and she was not there. The realization that something was fundamentally wrong was not a sudden epiphany. It was a slow, creeping dread, an accumulation of small, unsettling details. He found himself watching her, trying to understand the change. He saw a woman who was perfectly composed, perfectly polite, and utterly, terrifyingly, remote. The quiet warmth he had begun to unconsciously associate with her presence was gone, replaced by a polished, impenetrable chill. He started asking questions. "Mrs. Gable," he said to the housekeeper one morning, trying to sound casual, "who is it that plays the pianoforte in the evenings?" The housekeeper looked surprised. "Why, the Duchess, Your Grace. She has always been a great musician. Her father, Lord Vance, mentioned it was her only solace." Her only solace, the words lodged in his mind. And the music had stopped. He sought out Mr. Finch, who was visiting again to go over the quarterly reports. The ledgers were still perfect, but Alistair noticed something was different. The witty, insightful little notes in the margins were gone. The queries were still there, but they were stark, factual, stripped of the personality that had so surprised him before. "Finch," he began, gesturing to the books. "The Duchess, has she seemed unwell to you?" Finch looked at him over the top of his spectacles, his gaze unnervingly direct. "Unwell? No, Your Grace. Merely diligent. She performs her duties with admirable efficiency." The solicitor paused, then added, his voice carefully neutral, "although one might say the soul has rather gone out of the house since she quieted." The soul has rather gone out of the house. The phrase haunted Alistair. It was true. The house ran perfectly, but it felt like a museum, a beautiful, well-maintained, lifeless place. He had a duchess who was a perfect administrator, a perfect hostess, a perfect ornament, and he felt as if he were living with a ghost. The final piece of the puzzle clicked into place a week later. Driven by a restless anxiety he could not name, he began to search for her. Not just to see her at dinner, but to find her in her own habitat. He checked the morning room, the music room, the drawing room, They were all empty. He finally found her in the most neglected part of the estate, the old, dilapidated conservatory at the far end of the walled garden. It was a ruin of glass and rusted iron, a skeleton of its former glory. But inside, in a small corner that still caught the sun, she had cleared a space. She had set up a small table and was surrounded by pots of struggling seedlings. She was not arranging flowers. She was sketching them. On the table were sheets of paper covered in drawings of staggering detail and precision. The intricate vein structure of a leaf, the cross-section of a stem, the delicate anatomy of a petal. They were not the idle watercolors of a gentlewoman. They were the meticulous, analytical drawings of a botanist. She was so absorbed in her work she did not hear him approach. He stood in the doorway and watched her. He saw the intense concentration in her eyes, the deft, certain movements of her hand. He saw a woman of hidden passions, of deep and serious intellect, a woman he did not know at all. He had married a stranger, a brilliant, capable, and profoundly unhappy stranger. And suddenly, he knew. He did not know how he knew, but the certainty was absolute. This withdrawal, this silence, this emptying out of her spirit, it was a reaction to something. It was a choice. A quiet, devastating assertion of her own agency. He thought back. When had it started? He traced the timeline in his mind. The flowers had stopped appearing on his desk shortly after Harrington's visit. The music had ceased. The light in her eyes had gone out. Harrington, a cold fury, unlike anything he had ever experienced, seized him. It was a clean, sharp, clarifying rage. He turned without a word and left the conservatory. He rode to London that same day, his horse a lather of sweat and foam. He did not stop until he was at the door of Lord Harrington's club. He found him in the smoking room, holding court with his usual circle of sycophants. Alistair walked directly to him, his face a mask of cold fury. Harrington, a word. His tone cut through the jovial atmosphere like a shard of glass. The room fell silent. Harrington, looking unnerved, followed him to a private antechamber.
Blackwood, what is the meaning of this?
Harrington began, attempting his usual bluster. Alistair's voice was lethally quiet. My wife, during your last visit to my home, you had a conversation with Sir Roland. You repeated something I said to you on my wedding day. Words concerning my wife. Harrington paled. It was a jest, a bit of wine-fueled nonsense. Tell me exactly what you said. It was not a request. It was a command, backed by the full, terrifying weight of his ducal authority. Stammering, Harrington recounted the conversation, his eyes shifting nervously around the room. He repeated the words, the careless, cruel, damnable words. She is easily replaced. Alistair felt the blood drain from his own face. Hearing them spoken in this sordid little room, hearing them for what they were, the arrogant, dismissive pronouncement of a blind fool, made him physically ill. He had not just insulted her, he had negated her. He had defined her as a fungible object, a thing without intrinsic worth. He looked at Harrington, a man he had called a friend, and saw nothing but a shallow, empty vessel. Our acquaintance is at an end, Alistair said, his voice flat and final. If you ever speak my name or my wife's name again, I will ruin you. I will dismantle your life piece by piece, and I will enjoy doing it. Is that understood? Harrington, white-faced and trembling, could only nod. Alistair turned and walked out of the club, leaving a stunned silence in his wake. The ride back to Blackwood Manor was a journey through a personal hell. Anaphora pounded in his head with the rhythm of the horse's hooves. He thought about the perfect ledgers and his dismissive comment about a useful hobby. He thought about the music he had heard and never inquired about. He thought about the flowers on his desk, small daily offerings of beauty he had accepted without a single word of acknowledgement. He thought about a woman with the mind of a scholar and the soul of an artist, a woman he had treated as little more than a superior housekeeper. He had been wrong. Not just wrong in a single, careless statement, but wrong in his entire perception of the world, of his marriage, of her. He had been a blind, arrogant fool. He arrived back at the manor late at night, mud-spattered and exhausted. He went directly to the library. It was dark, save for a single lamp burning on a small table in the corner. She was there. She was sitting in a high-backed chair, the repaired atlas open on her lap. She looked up as he entered, her expression unreadable. He walked towards her, stopping a few feet away. He did not know where to begin. "I'm sorry," felt pathetic, inadequate. He chose the truth. "I have just come from London," he said, his voice raw. "I spoke with Lord Harrington." He saw a flicker of something in her eyes, surprise, perhaps. But she said nothing. She waited. "I know what you overheard, on our wedding day, and again, when he visited." He took a breath, the confession, a physical weight in his chest. "I said those words. She is easily replaced. There is no excuse. There is no justification. They were the words of a man who was profoundly ignorant. A man who could not see the treasure that was right in front of him." He looked at her still, pale face illuminated by the lamplight. "I was wrong," he said, the words simple, unadorned, and more difficult to say than anything he had ever said in his life. "I was wrong about everything." Eleonora closed the large atlas on her lap. The sound was a soft, definitive thud in the quiet room. She looked at him, her gaze level and direct for the first time in months. There was no anger in her eyes. There was no triumph. There was only a deep, weary sadness. "Words are easily spoken, Your Grace," she said, her voice as quiet as the rustle of a turning page. "Just as they were before." He knew then that this was not the end of the conversation, but the beginning. An apology was not enough. A confession was not absolution. He had broken something, and the mending of it would require more than just words. It would require a fundamental change in his very being. The next day, he did not go to his study. He did not ride out with his steward. He went to the dilapidated conservatory. He found her there again, tending to her seedlings. He did not yet care. He simply picked up a rusted trowel and began to clear the weeds from a long neglected flower bed. She watched him for a long time, her expression unreadable. He worked for hours, his hands, unaccustomed to such labor, becoming blistered and sore. He was clumsy, inefficient, but he was persistent. At midday, she left without a word. He thought she had gone for good, but she returned 20 minutes later with a tray bearing a pitcher of water, a glass, and a plate of bread and cheese. She set it down on a cleared patch of stone bench and then returned to her own work. It was not forgiveness, but it was not dismissal, either. It was a beginning. He took a decisive action a week later. He called Mr. Finch back to the manor. In Eleonora's presence, in the library, he instructed the solicitor to draw up a new deed. He was to sign over the deed to a small, charming property on the estate, a dower house known as Hollyhock Cottage, which came with its own walled garden and a modest income from its tenant farm. The deed was to be in her name alone. It would be hers, absolutely and unconditionally, to do with as she wished. "It is yours," he said to her, after Finch had left them. "A place of your own. You are not a guest in my house, Eleonora. You are its duchess. But you should also have a space that belongs to no one but you." It was an act of profound respect for her autonomy. It was an acknowledgement that she was not an asset, not a part of the estate, but a person in her own right. She accepted the deed with a quiet nod. The reserve in her eyes remained, but he thought he saw a softening around the edges. Trust, once shattered, was a fragile thing. It had to be regrown, slowly and patiently, like one of her delicate seedlings. Thus began the Duke's strange and difficult courtship of his own wife. He started to learn her language. It was not a language of words, but of actions, of attention. He began to see. He saw that she loved the library, not just for the books, but for the light that fell through the high-arched windows in the late afternoon. So he had the old heavy velvet curtains replaced with lighter ones that would not block the sun. He saw that the pianoforte in the music room was old and slightly out of tune. He traveled to London and consulted with the finest instrument makers, purchasing a new grand piano, a magnificent instrument of rosewood and ivory, and had it installed while she was out walking. He did not announce it. He simply left the room open, a silent invitation. A week later, he heard music again in the evenings. It was hesitant at first, then grew in confidence, filling the silent house with a beauty he now understood was a reflection of her own soul. He stopped asking her about menus and household matters. Instead, he brought her the estate reports. He asked for her opinion on crop rotation, on the new mill, on a dispute with a tenant. He did not do it as a patronizing gesture. He did it because he had finally realized her mind was sharper and more insightful than his own in these matters. He listened to her. He truly listened, and their conversations, once stilted and formal, began to flow. They talked of books and politics, of botany and finance. He discovered she had a dry, intelligent wit that often caught him by surprise and made him laugh. Alistair was a man transformed. The arrogant, detached Duke was being chipped away, revealing a man who was capable of attention, of care, of humility. He was learning to see not just Eleonora, but the entire world around him, with new eyes. He found he was more interested in the success of her experimental garden than in the gossip from his London clubs. He found more pleasure in a quiet dinner and a shared conversation with his wife than in any grand social event. The final test of their new, fragile bond came in the form of an external threat. A distant cousin of his father's, a grasping and litigious man, emerged from obscurity to launch a legal challenge against the estate. The claim was based on a supposed debt and mismanagement from a decade prior, during the period when the estate's books were in complete chaos. It was a vexatious but dangerous claim, one that could tie up the Blackwood fortune in the courts for years. Alistair's solicitors were grim. The old records were a nightmare. Proving the claim false would be a Herculean task of forensic accounting. It was Eleonora who saved him. She had, in her initial, quiet reorganization of the estate office, not thrown anything away. She had simply sorted it. In a series of dusty, forgotten deed boxes, she had found and cataloged years of old receipts, letters, and daily journals kept by his father's notoriously meticulous secretary. Working late into the night for weeks, she cross-referenced these disparate documents with the chaotic ledgers. She pieced together the financial history of the estate like a brilliant detective solving a complex crime. She found it, a single faded letter from the cousin acknowledging the full and final settlement of the very debt he was now claiming was unpaid. It was tucked inside a book on animal husbandry. There was also a corresponding entry in the secretary's journal. The proof was absolute. She did not present it to him with a flourish. She simply laid the letter and the journal on his desk one morning. "I believe this is what your lawyers have been looking for," she said quietly. He looked at the documents, then at her. He saw the faint smudges of ink on her fingers, the tired lines around her eyes. She had worked tirelessly, not for the Blackwood estate, but for him. It was an act of loyalty, of partnership. The legal challenge evaporated overnight. The cousin vanished back into obscurity. That evening, Alistair did not find her in the library or the conservatory. He found her at Hollyhock Cottage. She was in the garden she had cultivated from nothing, a riot of color and life under the setting sun. He walked up to her and took her ink-stained hands in his. "You saved me," he said, his voice thick with an emotion he no longer tried to hide. She looked down at their joined hands. "We saved the estate," she corrected softly. "No," he insisted, his grip tightening slightly. "You saved me. From my own blindness, from my own arrogance, from a life of emptiness that I was too foolish to even recognize." He looked at her, this woman he had once dismissed as plain, as a simple transaction, and saw the most extraordinary person he had ever known. He saw her intelligence, her resilience, her quiet strength, her hidden passions. He saw the woman who played Chopin in the dark, and who could bring a dying garden back to life. That man, the one who spoke those foolish, cruel words on our wedding day. He is gone, Alistair said. You have replaced him with someone who sees you, Eleonora, who values you above all things, who loves you. He had never spoken the word love to her before. It hung in the fragrant evening air between them, a thing of immense weight and terrifying vulnerability. She finally looked up, and for the first time, he saw past the reserve, past the quiet dignity, and saw the woman she had kept hidden away. There were tears shining in her eyes. I had hoped, she whispered, that he might be. He drew her into his arms, and as he held her, he felt the last of the ice around his own heart finally melt away. He had started with a transaction and ended with a treasure. He had thought her a placeholder, only to discover she was the entire foundation. He had believed she was easily replaced, and had spent the better part of a year discovering the profound, irrefutable, and joyous truth. He was the one who would be utterly, irrevocably lost without her. A year later, the conservatory at Blackwood Manor was no longer a ruin. It was a marvel of glass and light, restored to its former glory and filled with exotic plants and flowers from around the world. It was a joint project, a testament to their partnership. Alistair had provided the funds and the engineering, Eleonora the botanical genius and the artistic vision. It was their shared sanctuary. One bright autumn afternoon, Alistair stood in the conservatory, watching his wife. She was showing their infant son, Arthur, the velvety petals of an orchid. The baby gurgled, reaching out a tiny, clumsy hand. Eleonora laughed, a sound that was still new and precious to him, a sound he had worked so hard to earn. The house was no longer silent. It was filled with the sounds of life, the laughter of a child, the murmur of conversation, the rich chords of a pianoforte played with passion and joy. The soul had returned, more vibrant than ever before. Mr. Finch, visiting on business, found the Duke there. The old solicitor watched the domestic scene for a moment, a rare, small smile touching his lips. A remarkable transformation, Your Grace, Finch observed, looking around the thriving conservatory. For the garden and the house. Alistair did not take his eyes off his wife and child. The transformation was mine, Finch, he said quietly. I was merely the last to notice. He thought back to his initial assessment of his marriage, of his wife. An arrangement, a duty, a problem solved. He had been looking at a masterpiece and seeing only the canvas. He had been listening to a symphony and hearing only the silence between the notes. His greatest accomplishment was not in managing his vast fortune or his ancient title, but in the simple, arduous, and deeply rewarding act of learning to see the woman who had been there all along, waiting patiently in the quiet spaces he had been too blind to enter. She was not a role to be played, but a world to be discovered. And he knew, with a certainty that settled deep in his bones, that he would happily spend the rest of his life exploring it.